A plan to cut vehicle emissions in more than a dozen Northeast states is now dead.
Billions of dollars in federal COVID aid for Massachusetts will remain in the bank, likely for several more months, as state lawmakers recess without finalizing plans for putting the money to use.
And politics gets personal in North Adams. The outgoing mayor says a state representative threatened his family.
You're listening to And Another Thing and our Friday review of the week's news. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. Also ahead, COVID-19 booster shots for almost everyone.
Let's welcome our panel today. We have WSHU digital editor Dave Eisenstatter.
Hi.
Also along for the ride, iBerkshires.com executive editor Tammy Daniels. Great to have you back.
Yep, good to be here.
And let's welcome back editor-in-chief of Western Massachusetts Politics and Insight, Matt Safransky.
Hey, how's it going?
So, panel, Thanksgiving, other holidays are approaching. Formal sessions of the Massachusetts legislature have concluded for this year. One major issue that is still unresolved, how exactly to spend the billions of dollars in federal COVID aid relief funding. Governor Baker calls it irresponsible for lawmakers to keep that funding out of circulation and from doing the good it's intended to do.
We basically are stuck in neutral when many other parts of the country are making investments in their people and in their communities and in their economy and moving forward. And I really think this is something the legislature needs to get finished.
Matt, let's start with you. Do lawmakers not feel pressure to get the money into people's hands? What's the sticking point here?
I mean, I think the sticking point is just general disagreement, which is nothing new for the legislature. And I'm going to go and say, I think another issue is that I think that they have yet to figure out how to function properly after, you know, 20 months of COVID. There's a story in the Globe about how it might be the only state that doesn't have its state house open. And I think that that has an effect on things as well. It's harder to convey urgency. It's harder to, you know, twist arms when everything's done remotely. I mean, we've been governed more or less by acclamation, even with remote voting, for the last 20 months. And I'm not sure this is one of those issues that you can do as easily. I mean, it might be a little bit easier when the conference committee between the House and the Senate meet, because they probably will be in person or less virtual. But I think this is all a factor in the slow pace of it. And I mean, I know cases are going up, but it's still like, you know, government has to go on, and either it will or it won't.
Tammy, states will have some say over the use of the just approved $1 trillion federal infrastructure spending bill. Like this process in Massachusetts, should we be prepared for that to also be a drawn out process?
I think anything dealing with government and spending money tends to be a long drawn out process to begin with. So even if they can come to a deal on how to spend this bounty, and I think when you have that much money circulating and coming into the state, there is guaranteed to be differences in how all that money needs to be spent. I think there's a pipeline, right? And the pipeline wants to have guarantees that this money is going here and there, and then you have to pull it through the state and send it out into the community. So yeah, I think there could be a very long drawn out process as we see it. So even if they come to an agreement, it may be months before some of this money even starts to appear.
Turning to Connecticut for a moment, Connecticut in a different way is also sitting on their own reserves, which are very flush right now. Our show yesterday, we had a couple of Connecticut lawmakers to talk about how their priorities and where to spend this money are competing. Dave, looking at where Connecticut is right now, what do you see? Where do you think that money needs to go?
Well, just like in Massachusetts, I mean, I think the stalled infrastructure projects and, public health infrastructure, projects of interest in local municipalities that they're counting on for the state to release money. I mean, that's why it's so important that the Massachusetts legislature gets its act together, because all of these types of projects can't happen unless this money gets released. This should be like a good news story, right? It's extra money, money for stuff that people want and people need. But instead, you have, kind of typical Massachusetts dysfunction. So, I think that, there are a lot of stalled projects and a lot of stuff that needs to get done.
I think just to follow up on what Dave said about dysfunction and all these projects sitting around, I could name off like a half a dozen projects in Berkshire County right now that have been sitting out there waiting. There is a bridge in Clarksburg that the town cannot afford to fix, and it's one way on one of the five major roadways in this town. They don't have any money to fix it. There's a section of Route 8 in Adams that the town of Adams is responsible for that has not been paved in years, and it's full of potholes, and everybody's trying to drive down the middle of the road to stay away from the potholes on the side. So really, you know, we're coming to the end of construction season, and I think by spring, we would like to see some of the stuff getting done and, you know, moving that money along to get some of this infrastructure in place.
And beyond the physical stuff, there's also just money for services that's really important. I know that mental health spending was a sticking point, and there's, in both states, Connecticut and Massachusetts, there's a real mental, probably across the country, a real mental health services crisis that people are dealing with now. And there's money that could be spent on that.
I was just going to agree with Dave, huge mental health problems out here and there aren't beds and there aren't therapists and there aren't ways for people to seek treatment after 2 years of COVID. It's a serious issue.
And it's expensive, no doubt about it. Ambitious plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles in the Northeast that once included more than a dozen states, plus the District of Columbia, is no longer, with the final two states, Connecticut and Massachusetts, giving up on it this week. The Transportation and Climate Initiative, or the TCI, was a proposed cap and trade system of permits for sellers of gasoline that would have added an estimated 5 to 9 cents a gallon to the cost of gas. With rising gas prices that proved too high a price for states originally interested, earlier this week, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont said the TCI was not something he could continue to pursue.
Had a hard time doing TCI when gas prices were at historic lows. So it's probably not the year to do it this year with gas prices where they are.
Without a single other state willing to pursue TCI, aides to Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said yesterday that Massachusetts is now also giving up on the idea. Tammy, we were just talking about the cost of other services. While voters recognize the importance of climate change, is the cost to fix this issue the actual problem?
I think at this point in time, it is. I think there has to be a political will to put on a tax on gas prices that are rising. And it is a regressive tax, and it's a tax that particularly affects urban and suburban areas in Western Mass. There's very little public transportation. So any increase in taxes immediately affects people's abilities to get to work, to get to school, to get to the places they need to be, which could be anywhere from a half an hour to an hour now. But maybe it's also short-sighted in that we need to take some kind of action, but you need to have critical mass. Maybe a gas tax was not the way to go about it. Maybe instead of almost punishing people, we need to put encouragement on the other end towards, say, electric vehicles or other ways to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the TCI was basically in some ways sort of trying to do what happened anyway with these higher gas prices. There was supposed to be a disincentive to drive, and now there already is a disincentive to drive. And that's probably one of the reasons why this is all falling through now.
And Matt, from your perspective, watching how this TCI has actually disintegrated from what was such a great idea, is it the cost structure that's too much of a problem?
Well, I think that's probably where the political problem arises. I mean, it's reasonable to question how effective it would necessarily have been anyway. I mean, people have, you know, continued to drive and continue to drive expensive gas guzzling vehicles, despite the ups and downs in prices. So, I'm not sure that it would have had the impact that it would have wanted. It might have, you know, provided some funding to, you know, improve alternatives that don't necessarily pollute as much. But I mean, that's somewhat speculative and could be years or decades down the road before those projects are finished. I'm not entirely sure that there is an easy way to get people out of their cars. Maybe, you know, better investments in, you know, alternatives that don't require new infrastructure like buses, but you know, it's always very difficult to get people to just choose the alternative. And I'm not sure 5 or 9 cents on the gallon of gas was going to do it.
We're reviewing the news of the week on And Another Thing with this week's panel, iBerkshires.com executive editor Tammy Daniels, Western Massachusetts politics and inside editor-in-chief Matt Safransky and WSHU digital editor Dave Eisenstadter. Thank you again for joining us on This Week in Review.
Let's turn now to a topic that is going to concern many people as holiday travel starts to pick up all across New England. The numbers of COVID cases are surging, the highest rates currently in New Hampshire. According to data confirmed and collected by the CDC, and as reported by the Boston Globe, as of Monday, the seven-day average of new cases per 100,000 residents is 58 in New Hampshire, 52.5 in Vermont. In Massachusetts, that's 27.6. Connecticut's doing the best right now. The rate is 16.1, though it appears to be rising sharply. Now, until today, federal guidelines had limited COVID-19 booster shots to people older than 65 or people in certain high-risk jobs with medical conditions. But some New England states, including Maine and Rhode Island, and Connecticut and Massachusetts, have opened up booster shots to anyone older than 18. Here's Connecticut's Public Health Commissioner, Manisha Juthani.
If you got vaccinated 7, 8, 9, 10 months ago, like I did, since I was first vaccinated in December and January, your immunity is most certainly waning.
So we have states that are opening up booster shots to everyone. Federal regulators today did the same thing. What does it tell us that states seem to be leading the charge here when it comes to trying to distribute and immunize their populations? Tammy, do you have thoughts?
We all know that when the vaccines were first coming out, there was a struggle to keep up with the demand, right? Because they were just starting them up. I mean, they've been in process for almost a year now, and I don't see why we need to sort of parcel them out the way we did the first time around. I mean, initially we wanted to make sure the people who were the most vulnerable got those shots first. I'm not seeing that we really need to do that anymore. There doesn't seem to be any lack of vaccines, so why not just open it up to everybody at this point?
We're also getting to the point where I think it was opened up about you'd be getting your second shot right about 6 months ago. So this is the time that science is saying that particularly for Pfizer and even more for Johnson & Johnson, that the efficacy is waning. So if people are going to get their boosters, they really should be getting them now.
I think one of the difficulties here is trying to, you know, push through a rapidly changing situation through a regulatory system that simply wasn't designed for, this kind of pandemic. I mean, there was no flu vaccine in 1918. There wasn't FDA, but it doesn't matter. There wasn't a flu vaccine then. But the other problem is a science communications issue on a lot of levels too. I'm not saying that everybody shouldn't get a booster. They absolutely should. However, the people who really, really need it are people of a certain age who are more vulnerable and need the extra boost in antibodies. And there hasn't been a very effective way to both make it available to everybody and emphasize that people at risk are getting the booster, not a question of first, but just getting it at all. And that's to say nothing of the fact that hundreds of thousands or millions of people, even in New England, who haven't gotten vaccines at all. They still represent the lion's share of hospitalizations and deaths in New England from COVID-19.
But I think as we get closer to, at least we can get closer to 80%. And I'm not sure, I mean, I haven't really following up on why we still have a lack of people getting vaccines that are available. I think we need to continue that outreach.
Why there will be no defamation trial in Connecticut for right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. When we return here on And Another Thing, we asked the panel this week to weigh in on the InfoWars host and his recent legal proceedings surrounding comments related to the Sandy Hook shootings. Reviewing some of the top news stories of the past week here on And Another Thing, I'm Dara Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. With us this week are Western Massachusetts Politics and Insight Editor-in-Chief Matt Safransky, WSHU Digital Editor Dave Eisenstadter, and iBerkshires.com Executive Editor Tammy Daniels. Thank you all for being here.
Conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones says it's a matter of free speech. He now admits prior claims he made that the fatal shootings of school children at Sandy Hook Elementary School never happened were indeed untrue. Some families have filed defamation suits in both Texas and Connecticut, though there will be no trial. Because Jones and his lawyers repeatedly failed to comply with court orders to turn over evidence, the judge in the case took the rare step this week of entering a default verdict in favor of the families. The case now moves to the phase of determining how much they collect in damages. Chris Maddy is the family's lawyer.
He fabricated evidence. He falsely withheld evidence. And as a result of that, the judge concluded that the unusual remedy of default was the only just outcome here.
Matt Safransky, after a judge in Texas had taken pretty much the same action, is this a big surprise?
Not really. Conduct in this case has been, you know, I suppose unsurprising, but, you know, for a normal acting judiciary would be completely reprehensible. In my other capacity as a lawyer, I've actually appeared in front of the judge who was involved in this case. And I'm not at all surprised that she had no tolerance for the kind of stuff that was going on. I mean, she's been threatened herself, I mean, in the course of this proceeding. So, I mean, there just comes a point where it's like you just can't let somebody keep going on with this without any particular penalty.
Dave, WSHU is an NPR sister station in Connecticut, a place where Sandy Hook happened, but the feelings still today are raw. How is this verdict, how is this settling within the people of Connecticut?
I mean, as you point, I mean, the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre is in Newtown is one of the worst gun violence related tragedies the country has seen. 20 young school children, 6 educators. I mean, this is something that is felt nationwide and in particular in Connecticut. And I think having someone like Alex Jones rile up people by lying about the fact that it even happened, you know, that really hits home for a lot of people. And, you know, and in particular, the evidence that he failed to produce what they were looking for, my understanding is that, you know, they're trying to prove basically that he's making money off of telling these lies. And, you know, I think just most people's sense of justice, I think, would want to see something like that, would want to see the evidence of that and would want to have a ruling out of that. So, you know, so I think that's kind of been some of the feelings, I think, certainly among people that we've spoken to and you know, I'm sure throughout the communities.
And Tammy, Dave makes a good point. Alex is making profit off of not just the lies, but the lies of children and their families. Whatever check he writes, will it be big enough?
You know, it's not even a matter of money, because that check will never be big enough to replace to bring justice to these families who've been pilloried after having a horrific tragedy. And it is very disappointing to find that this is going to be a default, because a trial would have at least exposed some of this. You know, we're journalists and we're expected to do our due diligence. We make mistakes. We say the wrong things sometimes, but we always have to be the thing that we have to correct our mistakes as we go along. We have to make sure what we're doing, what we're saying is the truth as much as we know it. And to have someone like this say, oh, well, it's freedom of speech, that First Amendment right. You don't have a First Amendment right to lie to people. You don't have a First Amendment right to be irresponsible, I believe. I think, you know, when you have a bully pulpit like he has, to say the types of things that he says is just, it's beyond the pale. And I'm really sort of depressed when I heard that this was going to be a default motion. I really think at some point, somebody has to put a stop to this. And I think the only way to do that is to expose it, right? Because that's what we do as journalists. We expose things and let people see it for what they are.
All right, moving on. Our last topic for today. Politics in North Adams has made some headlines this week. Outgoing Mayor Tom Bernard has called for a House ethics investigation of State Representative John Barrett. While the two were discussing a matter before the city council, Barrett allegedly made some comments that the mayor said he found threatening.
The proposed action that I plan to take would be bad for my job, my career, and my family. And I really felt that last word was over the line.
Barrett insisted that this was not a threat, just an attempt to give some advice.
I said, you know, when you open yourself up basically for criticism, it not only will hurt you professionally, but it also ends up, unfortunately, as I have experienced in my long career, it comes back to hurt the family and things that are being said about you.
All right, panel. Do we think this is serious? Is Mayor Bernard overreacting? Was Representative Barrett out of line? Tammy, what are your thoughts?
Well, I know there is no love lost between them. And I know that Representative Barrett has a reputation for being pugnacious. Sometimes he revels in it and sometimes he gets slapped about it. But I do think sometimes when you start talking about family on an issue that is mainly about whether or not you're going to sell a vacant theater, you know, maybe that was one step too far. You know, I don't know. I'm not having been the person who actually heard it or been in the room. You can only kind of, you know, take what you're hearing from both sides. They both admitted that the family was used, and maybe that's just not something that shouldn't have been said. That's all.
Matt, had you heard anything interesting about this in the course of your reporting on Western Mass politics?
Not specifically. I don't know that it hasn't really reverberated into other thinking of legislators closer to my area in the Springfield area. I think I agree with Tammy that, you know, there could be a lot of personality in this as much as anything else. I mean, that would be an extremely brazen thing for somebody to be, you know, basically saying, you know, that's a nice looking career you have there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it, you know. And there's also the fact of, like, you know, why would you say that? Why would you put yourself in that kind of position? What could you really do to undermine somebody? I mean, without running afoul of, you know, several dozen state and federal laws. I don't see that following through. I mean, I think maybe both sides just kind of need to take a step back and take a deep breath.
And to just look at it, it's a former mayor telling a soon to be former mayor how to do his job. You know, I mean, in a few months, it's in some ways going to be moot anyway, because there's going to be a new mayor.
Pretty much my thoughts exactly. Thanks again to our panel. Editor-in-Chief of Western Massachusetts Politics and Insight, Matt Safransky, it was great to have you. WSHU Digital Editor, Dave Eisenstatter, thanks so much for being here. And iBerkshires.com Executive Editor, Tammy Daniels, a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thank
and thank you to our listeners for joining us today and throughout the week. A reminder that you can catch up on more programs. Visit us at the And Another Thing page at nepm.org. You can also engage with us on social media. Across platforms, it's at AAT on NEPM. I'm Derek Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. Be sure to join us next week.